Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Dave, how are you doing down there?
I'm doing great. It is the beginning of IVEX. You know, this is our favorite time of the year.
I know it.
But we are stuck at home, so
yeah, yeah.
What are you going
to
do?
Everybody's posting on Facebook that they'd be headed to IVEX or already there, and lots of great photos and memories being shared. And of course, by the time this airs, IVEX will already be a week in the past.
Yeah.
But I know, you know, we're both missing all our friends and claimed families, if you will.
Yeah.
We always look forward to seeing every year. And certainly going to be a little bit different feel this year with the virtual platform, but hopefully everybody's lectures and technology and everything go off without a hitch, and everybody has a good time. And of course, we're doing the Zoom call after the welcome reception.
Right. Yeah, we're going to do that on Sunday night,
and we're going to post the link to that tonight. Of course, again, I know when this airs, it'll be in the past, but a lot of people seem to be excited about coming by for that. So really looking forward to that. And I head home actually next week for a week to find, you know, for Molly and I to get jobs and get a place lined up, because we're moving in about 6 weeks now.
Yeah, it's coming up. It's coming up quick.
And you know, it's going to be a little eerie going back to California with everything that's going on out there right now with the fires and all the West Coast. And yeah, it's just been a crazy time. So we'll have we'll see how that.
Do you guys have a place to live yet, or are you just?
No, we're going to be working on that while we're out there as well. Yeah. That's, I think, other than interviews, that's the big thing, is we want to come back here with a place already lined up and not have to coordinate that from this far away. So we got a few places we're going to check out. And so,
well, you guys are both from California, so you kind of know where you
want to live. Oh yeah, we've done a little bit of research and kind of the areas we want to be, and so we've got some places to check out and appointments and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, so I think we're trying to do the best with it we can and move forward. So
such a scary time, like moving right into California in the time of fire season.
Yeah, for sure.
And normally back this way, this time of year, and I remember the last couple IVEX that we've gone to, there has been some delays of like, there's going to be a hurricane coming through.
Yeah.
And you know, 1 year, I think the year we went to New Orleans, we had to switch up our flights because they were getting canceled and all this stuff. And
I think the Nashville year where there was some concern as well.
But that was drivable. I didn't have a flight for that. That was a lot easier.
So we're, of course, we're missing our IVEX fam this week, but
I miss walking into the hotel, walking into the, like, the conference hotel, and just walking through that concourse, and then somewhere out of the periphery, somebody that I haven't seen in a year comes running up, and you know, us as introverts, we're like, it's you. Okay, all right, that's all right.
Yeah, for sure.
I will miss seeing everybody.
Yeah, and hopefully next year, you know, I think 2021 is Nashville. Hopefully we get back to in person, and the world is in a bit better place, and we can start moving forward with that again, and we get to see everybody actually in person next year.
That would be great.
That's for sure, I think, one of the biggest things I'm looking forward to of 2021. So.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, the other, you know, or not the other, but one other big thing going on with you and I is sports fans as we are. NFL started last night somehow, way.
I was a little surprised with all the fans that were actually at the stadium. So
I guess they're one of two stadiums that are going to allow some fans. So it was cool to see the moment of silence at the beginning of the game, and both teams kind of come together and lock arms. I was actually kind of surprised that in the coronavirus thing that they allowed, you know, the players, of course, but it's football, right? They're going to be in close contact anyway. Yeah. So I guess it's six in one hand, half dozen in the other. But it was really a bit disappointing to hear the booing from the actual fans that were there.
And it's so frustrating. And we're going to talk a lot about this today. Yeah. It's just frustrating to see people so insensitive and so
out of touch,
out of touch with everything. It baffles me. I just don't get it.
Yeah. And as you said in there, it's pretty timely because that's what we're going to be talking about today, you know, to some degree. So, you know, we've kind of looked at a couple of articles recently, and during our mental health series, we had an episode that was sponsored by AHA, and the gentleman there that we were working with, Chris Solberg, wrote an article, and we'll talk about that one in a second. But we just saw another one that came out this week in Today's Veterinary Business. And the article is How to Be an Ally. It's not the job of people who are marginalized to educate you. It's your job to catch up. What did you think?
I read through that, and you know, this is something that I've been trying to do for a long period of time, and there's so much information out there of what the right thing to do is, what the wrong thing to do is, and realizing that this article, it just came out like in August 2020.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, if you speak to 10 different people, you may get 7 or 8 different answers on what we should be doing. And
right.
When I say we, I mean you and I as white males of society,
right.
What are we supposed to be doing to help out,
right.
and how can we do this? And this kind of lays out some good examples of things that we need to do. You know, it kind of talks about it's not marginalized people's job to educate us, which kind of goes against everything we're doing today, as we're going to be talking with our guest and trying to get her to help educate us and point us in the right direction of things. But, you know, just looking at some of these things that they suggest is great information and things that, you know, I think we should think about when we're trying to figure out what exactly are we supposed to be doing. And,
right.
and that's the hard part for people like us, that we want to do the right thing, but we don't know what to do.
Right.
And this kind of points us in the right direction.
Yeah, for sure. And this article is written by Lisa Greenhill, and you know, she says the number one question she's asked, both as a black woman and diversity and inclusion professional, is what should I do?
Right.
She talks about being an ally, being a learned behavior. And you know, there's kind of, I think, 5 steps, if I'm not mistaken,
five
points. Yeah. And number one, like you talked about, it not being their job to educate us. But in that same point, she goes on to say, it like, we commit to lifelong learning in veterinary medicine. Allyship requires lifelong learning about racism, sexism, homophobia, ableism, basically all forms of oppression.
Right.
And that's a really important point, that like, we do lifelong learning in this profession just about something different. And it's just another thing that we need to learn about. And I think the other one for me that was a big point was, true allyship does not center the ally. It centers the oppressed, and you should expect to be a follower and not a leader.
Yeah.
And that's okay. I am very willing to learn and follow. And as you said, like, learn more than what I can do.
Yeah. Yeah. The third one that I looked at and I said, well, this one's kind of an easy one for me right now, is in today's cancel culture, stepping into allyship requires vulnerability. And I've seen this a lot from a lot of my friends on social media, and they usually say, this is what I feel. And if you do not align with this idea, unfollow me and unfriend me, let me know, because I don't want you in my life. And that's something where I'm perfectly willing and able to rid people in my life that are kind of not on board with this. And does that make me an ally? I guess in some way it does make me an ally, because I'm not tolerating some of that stuff,
right.
And not aligning myself with people that have those ideas that don't kind of line up with what I'm feeling and what's going on in the world right now.
Yeah.
And taking that risk of being able to alienate others and alienating myself, of saying, I'm not okay with this, and things need to change. And if you're not on board with this, then either we need to have a discussion or you need to move on. And that's something that's really simple for me right now, is I am more than happy to, I don't like using the word cancel culture, but I'm more than willing then to remove people of my life that are toxic people like this.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I was actually talking with Molly about this the other day, something I just thought of. I followed, I think it was the History Channel on Instagram, and they made a post because last week was the anniversary of the Arkansas 9 and desegregation in that particular high school in Arkansas. And it was, you know, a post about that. And in one of the pictures, you know, most of the pictures in the post were of the group of 9 students, kind of, and then the backdrop of all the other students in the school. And there was a close-up picture of one of the students and almost a mob, if you will, of angry white women behind her. And kind of, you could tell, like, obviously it was a still photo, but you could tell they were yelling and they were whatever else. And I got to thinking, this was 1957, I believe, 59, something like that. And
somewhere in there, yeah.
And those people are still alive today. We're really only one generation away from that. I mean, my parents were, you know, 9, 10 years old then.
Yeah.
And it's remarkable how far we haven't come, but it's also like, we're still not that far away from that kind of an incident. And I think my hope is that, you know, people of your or my age group, we're a little bit closer to where we should be, right? And then, you know, you don't have kids, I don't have kids, but like, hopefully kids of of our age group, they're even closer to where we should be. And each generation, we just keep getting closer and closer and closer and closer, and more of that gets weeded out, and more of this gets more deeply rooted. And I don't know.
Well, and that's another thing that's in, I don't know if it's in this article and the other one or the other one, but it says that allyship is something that's learned, and racism is also something that's learned. We're not born racist or anti-racist.
Yes.
We learn that behavior. And
you learn it. Yeah.
I think, like you said, the further we get along in generations, hopefully we can change that thinking to getting racial equality and getting social equality and things like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, Robin has a daughter, Ruby, and she's not in the same environment that we were when we were kids.
Right.
You know, she's taught inclusiveness. She's taught to be racially sensitive and socially sensitive to everything that's going on around her. And it's, I see a change in her that she's more comfortable with things in terms of social issues and racism than we were when we were kids. Because, I mean, you grew up in an extremely white area of Los Angeles. I grew up in an extremely white town in Massachusetts. So, you know, we weren't exposed to people of diverse cultures and things like that. But, but now, hopefully with more inclusion and more diversity, that's going to get weeded out.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. And
I do too.
And the other article that that we're going to post, and we'll post links to both of these, but it was written by Chris Solberg, who works with AHA. This was actually back in June. This was almost immediately post George Floyd. Was the article is committing to anti-racism in the veterinary profession. And what the big thing that sticks out to me is he cites a study that highlighted, or that was on Harvard Business School's Working Knowledge website, and it said Black job candidates in the United States were more likely to get an interview when they whitened their names. 25% received calls after submitting whitened resumes, while only 10% got callbacks when they left ethnic details on their on their applications. And he goes on to say, you know, in our profession, being realistically less racially diverse than many, you can almost extrapolate that out even further. You know, in our field. And there's some really great ways to do practice things and professional things and things in that article.
A lot of links in there. I was clicking on some of the links, and I was like, "Ooh, there's a lot of information here." So he did a great job with this. I'm really happy to go through this.
Yeah, and we're going to post a lot of these links because there's Facebook groups. There's the Multicultural VMA on Facebook group that we've talked about before. National Association for Black Veterinarians, Black DVM Network, and there's several others, and we'll post all those links as well. And I do also want to mention while we're talking about that is he reached out to us as well to let us know that AHA has an annual conference called Connexity, and there's a half-day workshop that's titled Diversity in Veterinary Medicine, Mentoring and Recruiting for Lasting Change. And they've set up a discount code for our listeners to register for the conference for $25 off. And of course, this year, 2020, that everything is canceled. It's actually going to be all virtual and on demand this year, so that code should be good for a full year, and technicians can get up to over 100 hours of CE, whether it's live or on demand. And we'll post all that too, but it's pretty cool that we can help.
Yeah, I was looking at that. There's a lot of people that are speaking at that.
Yeah.
And I think it's like a four hour seminar.
Yeah.
And I believe it starts on the 30th of this month, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, the conference live is September 30th through October 3rd. Yeah. But again, it's going to be on demand throughout the year. And so we'll have a discount code. You can just enter the code CAFE and if you go to register, but we'll put that on social media as well. Yeah. So really cool to be able to do that. I'm really proud that they were willing to do that for us and for our listeners and you know, try to bring more positive light to this kind of situation. So, well, what do you think? Without further ado, should we go ahead and bring out our guests and get to talking about some of this
stuff? We've been yammering on for a long time here.
Yeah,
I
know.
This is longer than most of our intros.
I know. Thanks for everybody for sticking with us. But we're going to be chatting with Teresa Cosper today. She's a registered veterinary technician in Louisiana. She's worked in a variety of specialties in veterinary medicine. And then ultimately, as we all do, fell in love with emergency and critical care. Spent several years working as an ICU technician before moving into her current position, managing a teaching lab in academia. She has a passion for teaching, so it should come as no surprise that she's been an adjunct instructor or guest lecturer for several veterinary technology programs. And when she's not working, she and her husband can be found chasing their three-year-old around. So, Teresa, thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. Can we get you a cup of coffee today?
Yes, please. I would like a white chocolate mocha latte.
Oh, ooh, that sounds really good.
I'm a fancy coffee drinker.
That sounds...
I love it.
That's great. We'll add that one to the list. We've got a running list going.
Yeah, we'll put that one on the menu for sure. So we always kind of start with our guests, having them take us through their career path, right? Like what drew them to veterinary medicine, kind of some of the twists and turns and steps along the way to get to where they got to now. So if you don't mind, take a few minutes and take us through some of that.
So as a little girl, I was always the kid who picked up lizards and bugs and brought them home, much to my mother's chagrin and horror sometimes. And it just sort of parlayed into a love of animals. When I was younger, I was a junior keeper and a keeper aide at our local zoo. And eventually, once I started college, my freshman year, I got a job as a kennel technician at a wonderful local practice, and I just fell in love. I wanted to go to vet school, and I was that person who, my major was always pre-vet, but I changed it every 2 seconds. Pre-vet biomedical engineering, and then pre-vet cellular and molecular biology, and by the time I was done, it ended up being what is it, Latin American Studies and Psychology. So pre-vet was always there, I jumped around a lot. I'm from Louisiana, so what made me actually decide to become a technician was Hurricane Katrina. We evacuated, and when we came back to Louisiana about a year later, there was an opening at a local specialty hospital, and I went there still wanting to be a doctor, and I worked there as an ER assistant, and I fell in love and realized that all of the things that I wanted to do as a doctor, doctors didn't do any of that. That was the technicians. So that is what brought me there. I spent a number of years working as an assistant. In Louisiana, even though we have credentialed technicians, everybody calls their technicians, whether they're assistants or not, everybody's called technicians. So I worked as a on-the-job trained technician for a while until I decided to go to school and become an RVT. I graduated from San Juan College, and I worked a few years at a private practice before I finally got up the nerve to apply for my dream job at a local vet school. And once I got that position, I suckered them in enough to hire me. From there, I worked in the ICU for 5 years before I eventually transitioned into a managerial role with one of the teaching laboratories.
Awesome. Awesome.
Thinking back to, you know, how you got to where you are and thinking about the profession as a whole, what is one thing that you really love about what you do right now? And what's one thing that you would change if you could?
One thing that I love right now is just being in academia. There's always something different. So I love having a change of pace. Even though I left ECC, I love the fact that things are constantly changing. If there was one thing that I would change about my career path, I don't think that I would have stopped at just the Associates of Applied Science. I think that instead of immediately starting to work, I should have gone on and gotten the Bachelor's of Applied Science in Veterinary Technology instead.
Okay.
Interesting.
But I think that that's the only change that I would make, if only because all of the decisions that I've made, even bad decisions, have taken me to where I am now.
It's very true.
I say that all the time. Yeah. A lot of times I've thought about things that I would do differently, but then I say, well, wouldn't have brought me to where I am, and things would be different. So I totally fall in line with that. Yeah.
How have you found working in an academic institution and working with veterinary students? I think so cool. Just, you know, they're basically little sponges, and you can mold them and shape them and help educate them into whatever it is that they're going to be. And I, you know, for all the struggles that I've had in my time at Tufts, I feel like that's still the best part. I mean, you know, Dave's a full-time teacher at a vet tech program. I was an adjunct professor at a vet tech program. You know, we both love teaching. Sounds like you do as well. You know, I think that's a lot of fun. How have you found working in that kind of environment?
I love it. Every year there's something different. I love my babies. I love watching them come in, and their first year, they're just shy and reserved. And I usually pick a person who's quiet, and by the end of that year, I have turned that person into the loudest, most outgoing person in the room. to me, the best part of academia is coming in and just seeing them evolve and become wonderful doctors. Yeah. The sad part about it is that eventually they all leave, just like little baby birds leaving the nest, and you fall in love and they leave you.
But then there's another class ready to be ushered in, and you kind of start the whole process all over again.
Jeff, you have names for those doctors. I remember hearing it on the Radio Vet Nurse podcast. What were the names that you had for those stages of doctors?
I call the students like fetal doctors, and then like when they're interns, they're baby doctors, and then when they're residents, they're toddler doctors, and then you know beyond that, they're whatever they are. But yeah. So, Teresa, did you get a chance? We sent you the articles that Dave and I kind of discussed in the intro, and I'd love to get your thoughts as we're going to be talking about, you know, largely racism in veterinary medicine today, and what that looks like, and things that, you know, Dave and I don't even think of. And first, before we kind of get into a lot of that, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what you thought about those two articles, if you don't mind.
I really liked the article. I think that as you addressed with the article on how to be an ally, the biggest thing is that if you're going to be an ally, the people who you are an ally for shouldn't have to explain why you should be an ally or explain why things are an issue. I think that in today's society, inequalities and social and socioeconomic issues that are present now are just so out there because of cell phones and Facebook and Instagram and whatnot, that no one should have to explain why things are unacceptable. And to go along with that, every time I have to explain something, I have to relive it and try to explain how it made me feel. So that's a very important part about being an ally. It's just, you need to do your own homework. I'm not going to do your homework for you.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. You know, I was actually having a conversation with somebody in this field just a couple of weeks ago on this very topic, and it wasn't about racism, but it was more like we were having a conversation about Facebook posts and whatever else. And his point was, nobody wants to do their own research anymore. They don't want to find out. They don't want to do the work. They don't want to. You know, it's not that hard to Google something or read a couple of articles. And his point was either ER Vet Tech Rounds or veterinary anesthesia nurse, somebody will just say, I have this case, what do I do? But not actually do any work, you know, instead of saying, hey, like, these are the drugs that I have available. This is what I'm thinking. This is why I want to do that. What would you guys do? Like, and it's the same thing here. Like, you still have to, you have to put in some effort.
And not just be spoon-fed the information. You actually have to go seek it out.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I agree. I think the importance with that and the analogy with the tech groups is that when you do things like that and you ask questions, you don't know the background of the person who's giving you answers or what their motives are. So it's important to research things for yourself and use in everything in life, for the most part, you can use the scientific method and review things and do your own research before you come to your own conclusions, instead of just relying on what someone else has told you.
Right.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot with social media, where people say, oh, I want to figure out this one little thing, and then they get one source, and suddenly that's what they do. And I think the same thing happens here with what we're talking about today, is they'll get one answer and say, this is exactly what it is, and not actually look at it and use that scientific method of testing that theory and kind of going down the rabbit hole of looking beyond just what's right in front of you and trying to figure out different things, as opposed to just getting one answer and saying, this is exactly what it is. Because like you said, you don't know that person's background. You don't know that person's experience. You don't know what they've been through. So it's really hard to kind of process some of that information without actually looking more around it, as opposed to just looking directly at it. Teresa, we're going to get into some real heavy questions now. Do you believe that racism is as prevalent in the veterinary setting as it is in society at large? Like, do you think there's an equal representation of that in society as it is in veterinary medicine?
It is incredibly prevalent. I live in Louisiana, and the comedian Dave Chappelle always loves to joke and says that he loves the racism in the South because it's just out in the open. There are no secrets in Mississippi. And it slaps you in the face. There, at least three or four times a day, I experience microaggressions, but there are also overt and obvious aggressions as well. There have been things that have been said to me or that I've seen in my career that are staggering. There are jokes that have been made in my presence that are unbelievable. And I will give you an example, and you may need to get your censor button ready, Dave. About 10 years ago, I had a job where we were all sitting around. We weren't doing, it was one of those just slow, not doing anything ER shifts. And people started telling jokes, and they started out as stupid little puns, and then they got progressively dirty and whatnot. And I don't think they realized that I was still in the room actually working. And one of my coworkers, who I thought I was friends with, made a joke. She said, "What do you call a black veterinarian from Alabama?"
Oh boy, I don't even want to know the answer.
I was in a cage behind a counter. They couldn't see me. And her response was, "A nigger." Everybody in the room laughed. And I got up, walked out, and I never went back. And it's...
Oh my God.
Being in Louisiana, things like that are, they're normal.
And you thought that was a... You saw her as a friend at that point, right?
We went out with each other after work. We did stuff. We went to bird fairs together and just... We hung out. I legitimately thought that we were friends. So to hear that come out of her mouth, and yes, I'm assuming she didn't know that I was in the room because I was behind a counter in a cage with a patient. That part hurts more, because would she have not said it if I was there? Probably not. But that shows you that you can't actually trust that people that you work with, or just people in general, have your best interest in mind.
Yeah. Well, it just tells me that she's acting that way towards you face to face to hide the fact that she's not like that at all when you're not around. It's almost like that whole thing is like giving you, I don't want to say trust issues, but it's put up walls for you, right?
I will say that it has, situations like that have changed me at work. For the most part, it takes a very, very long time for me to warm up to people. I have one or two friends, but I don't talk as much because I don't want to put myself into a situation to where I trust someone or find myself befriending someone and then feeling betrayed afterwards.
Yeah.
I helped provide some stories for an article a while back on discrimination with a good friend of mine, Steven Sattel. And he asked for different stories that I had, and I gave him a story about my first job at a specialty hospital. It was my first night there. I was with the head ICU nurse, and I was, like I said, little baby assistant, still don't know what to do, and I was scared, and I was his shadow. And we had a patient come in who the owner thought that she was pregnant and was worried because it had been over the required amount of days, and she still hadn't whelped. And I looked at this dog. I could see, even with very minimal training, that this dog was too old to be having puppies. And the dog was losing its hair, it had ascites, it was obviously a dog that had some sort of cardiac issue. And we went back to the treatment area, the senior technician and I, and in the computerized medical record as the presenting complaint, he put that this dog's presenting complaint was being an NYD. And when I said, "Well, technician, I don't know what's an NYD?" This technician, without blinking, without being phased, as if it didn't matter what I thought, told me that an NYD is a nigger yard dog.
Wow. My goodness. I just...
He put that in the medical record as the dog's presenting complaint. It's definitely out there. I know that we're a field where people get into it because they love animals, and we all want to make a difference, and we want to make these animals' lives better. But it's also a shark tank, and things like that are the norm. I mean, I just told you two stories, but I have hundreds more, and they are things that will horrify you even more than that. So we are definitely in a very, very racist field. I will say that I feel like it has gotten better recently, just because things are coming more to the open, more universities, or at least as far as veterinary schools go, more than technical schools, they're recognizing that there's an issue that needs to be addressed.
I just hearing those two stories, I wouldn't even know what to say.
No.
Something like that came up at a job I was at a few years ago, and a technician used that word on a patient, and I wasn't in the room, but I imagine I probably would have had a lot to say to her at that point. But she was essentially fired for using that word. And I can't even bring myself to say the word. So I guess as being two white guys coming from backgrounds where we didn't have a lot of diversity when we were growing up. Me working in New Hampshire, I didn't have a lot of diversity up there, not only with clients, but with staff. Like I not until I moved to North Carolina did I work with anyone of color. You know, I don't remember that type of behavior being something that was happening even in a completely white dominated practice. And I can't imagine hearing those things in an area where there was a person of color there. Like, how did you react to that? What did you say to that?
For the NYD comment, I am not going to lie. I was in shock. I wasn't raised that way. I didn't say anything. I just stood there with this deer in the headlights look on my face. And at that time, like I said, I was a stupid little kid trying to get into vet school. I knew that working at that practice, which was the biggest specialty practice in our area, working at that practice would get me a good reference. So I didn't say anything. Yeah. And to this day, that is one of the biggest regrets in my life, is that I didn't say anything when he did that.
And how long ago was that?
I said 10 years, but that was about 15 years ago now that I think about it, because I apparently don't know what year this is. But
I think we're all going to take a mulligan on 2020. It's just not going to exist anymore.
Well, and just to think of that story, and you remember that in such vivid detail, and it's been 15 years. I understand why you didn't say anything, because as a young baby assistant, I mean, what are you going to do? You're not going to put your career at risk for saying that. But in hindsight, you probably do regret saying that, not saying anything. And not just you, because as a young baby assistant or baby technician or whatever you were at the time, but to not have having people there that have your back and somebody else speaking up or having allies.
I will say that one of the wonderful things about being an ally is that when you speak up, when you say something, even if as an ally you get nothing accomplished, if nothing changes, you've still made a difference, because you've let the person that's being marginalized know that you're not okay with it, and you've made it clear that you're not okay with it. If you're not sick of my stories, I have another story for you that goes along with that. One of my favorite doctors at my facility is a radiologist, and she's now the director of diversity. I had just started at a university working as an ICU nurse. I had been there for about a month or so. It was my first time working nights, and I was on shift with a technician who'd been there for a number of years, who was African-American as well. And it was the kind of shift that you have in your nightmares. Two other employees called in sick. So it was he and I, and just so you can feel pity for this man, senior technician and RVT with about 2 years experience, but woefully unprepared for what a university is like. And we had 24 patients.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. I don't think we sat down at all that night. We didn't have lunch. When people finally started drifting in that morning, a doctor came in, one of the residents, and she opened the door to her patient's cage and saw that her patient was sitting in urine. I had personally checked on that patient as I was doing treatments maybe 20 minutes ago. The first thing that I do when I open a cage is that I put my hand on the fleece to feel for urine, and then I put my hand under the fleece. So if there's pee or poop in that cage, I'm not missing it, because my hand's going in it, which is beyond disgusting. I don't know why I said that, but I did.
We do some crazy stuff.
Oh, yes. And she got livid, and she said that she guessed that she shouldn't be surprised that on the night that we were working that her patients would be in a disgusting condition, because it was par for the course with us whenever we worked together. And I looked at him, and like I had said, this was my first time working nights. This was my first time working with him. So what was the difference between when he and I worked and when other people worked? Unfortunately for this resident, when she said that, the radiologist, like I said, who is now my favorite doctor, she happened to be standing in the room. She was doing an ultrasound on an ER patient, and the technician and the resident started going back and forth. And this doctor, she's like, "That's enough." And she used her, I like to call it mom voice, that voice that even at 34 years old still scares me and makes me sit down and stop what I'm doing. And she pulled that doctor outside they were outside for maybe 2 minutes. That doctor came back in the room and apologized. And then the radiologist came up to me later that day and said, I think you've been doing a fantastic job. All of the patients look wonderful. I know it was stressful, so try not to take things like that to heart, but I promise you they won't happen again. She didn't have to say anything. And she did. To this day, I still remember that was 6 or 7 years ago. That is something that most of us, we'd just be like, oh, a jerk's a jerk, and go home and not think about it again. But the fact that she saw that what was happening was unacceptable and stood up and said something made a difference to me.
Yeah. Well, that's a good example of, you know, even some of the inconsequential things that may be inconsequential to us. Like the person who said that probably thought nothing of it.
Right.
But for you, that's a lasting memory. And the actions that we have, the things that we say do have impact. And we should not treat these things very lightly. We should not treat them as things to brush off, because they do make changes. They impact you. And, you know, that's probably changed your thought of that doctor that said that irreparably. Like, that's probably the only thing you think of when you think of that doctor from now on.
Right.
Yeah. And now the other doctor, that's your favorite doctor. And why is that? Because she stood up for you and took a stand for you.
Oh, absolutely. Probably,
you know, people that are trying to be allies are trying to do. We're not trying to be heroes. We're just trying to make a difference, and we're trying to make those changes that are going to make people have that lasting memory of us to say, this is someone I can trust, and this is someone that is going to have my back when I need them.
As a black technician in a very white dominated field, like, when you look at your coworkers, especially like white coworkers, if you could tell them, ask them anything, like, what do you expect of them? What do you like? Do you find race impacts your comfort level with coworker relations, anything like that? Like, I mean, I 100% would expect the answer to be something along the lines of just be treated as an equal. But is there anything else kind of along those lines that stands out to you?
Like you said, the biggest thing is just being treated as an equal. I will say that after you have worked with technicians for a while, and, you know, we're a very hard group to get into because technicians were just so temperamental. But once you're a part of that group, for the most part, other technicians will defend you to the death. It's like, I can talk about my coworker like a dog, but you better not talk about her. So it's almost like having siblings. So other than just being treated the same, there's nothing more that I need from my coworkers. I want us to be able to get through the day and take care of our patients and get everything done and go home.
Yeah.
How do we, and when I say we, I mean like white people, practice managers, practice owners, what have you, how do we incorporate more black culture into that hospital environment to try and lessen that assimilation of a black employee to a hospital that employs mostly white people? So how do we make it easier to make people of color feel welcome?
I have a different answer or a different perspective with that. I am in a bunch of management groups on Facebook. And one of the biggest things that I see in the management groups, things that I've heard, when IVEX was in New Orleans, I finally got to go because I'm a broke little technician and can't afford to fly if it's not nearby. But one of the management seminars that I sat in, the speaker said that she only hires for culture. She only hires people that fit in at her practice. And everybody in the room cheered. And at first I was like, man, that's a good idea. That way you don't have any issues. But then the more that I thought about it, and I was like, well, what is the culture at your practice? What are you trying to do? And by saying that you're hiring for culture and hiring people that fit in, you could be eliminating a lot of different diverse candidates that are amazing employees and amazing people because they don't fit with the ideal of what your practice is like. And they might, their religious beliefs or ethnic background and things of that nature might make the people in your practice slightly uncomfortable. So the biggest thing is to stop hiring for culture and hire the person who's best suited for the job. Once we start doing that, once managers recognize that hiring for culture is actually just discrimination, things will get better.
Maybe some of these places need a little bit of a cultural shift. You know, your current capacity is supervisor in nature. What kind of obstacles did you have to overcome, or did you feel like you had to overcome any to kind of get to that level? Or did you feel like you were pretty much, you know, maybe there was multiple people applying for the job and it was, you know, even keel across the board? Or did you feel like you had to work a bit harder and hustle a little bit more to get that kind of a position?
From childhood, little black girls are always told that they have to be twice as good to get half as much. And I know that that's a horrible thing to tell children, but it prepares them for the world. And it's been my experience that it's been true. I've been, for the most part, fortunate enough to work in places where there are constantly opportunities for advancement, just because in academia, people are always moving on to different areas. But I would be lying if I didn't say that sometimes I felt like other people were given opportunities that I didn't experience or that I wasn't privy to. And there was no reason that I could see why, based on my experience and my education and things of that nature. For my current position, someone retired, and given the position and the level of teaching that it requires, and at this point with my current job, I'd say maybe 20% of it is technical skills, and the rest of it's all managerial and teaching and ordering and HR components to it and whatnot. But there were very few people there who had the requirements necessary for that. And I had the technical background, I had the academic background because I taught, so my name was put up by a higher up. My name was presented, and they asked for a copy of my resume. I applied, and of those people that applied, and I don't even know how many there were, I was chosen to be the best candidate for the job based on talking to my boss almost daily, because I aggravate the crap out of that man. And based on my evaluations, I've done a fantastic job, but I don't think that race necessarily had an issue with or had an impact with my current position, but it's definitely been an issue with positions prior to this.
Do you feel like people's opinions of you have changed since you're now in a supervisory role?
I think that it's changed with people that I wasn't particularly close with. For all of my friends at the facility, nothing has changed. They all are proud of me. They're rooting for my success. For others, I think that there's a small part of jealousy that comes into play. And there are always comments made and little microaggressions. But other than that, I really don't think that given my particular position, I'm treated differently. I will say that just as a black person in a supervisory position, things are very different. And I'm going to try and say this and be as diplomatic and tactful as possible so that I don't get myself canceled. But I have noticed that someone can ask me a question and I give them an answer. And the answer that they get, they do not feel as satisfactory, and I end up getting a phone call from a superior about it. And then another technician with the same title and just a different specialty can give that same answer, and it's, okay, well, such and such said we can't do that, so we can't do that. But for the most part, things that I do are often questioned. Even when things are questioned, I can say, no, that decision was made because of this, 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 and this, and I'm one of those people who writes everything down. So I can say, no, I told you yes or no based on this situation, on this date, this thing that happened, this, 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 and this. I tend to be labeled as the angry black woman, mostly because I just have that face that's the mom face, tired of it, ready to go home. I have noticed that I am treated differently. I don't think it's intentional. Like I said, I think there are microaggressions. People don't even realize that they're doing it. But it has been immediately obvious in a lot of cases.
You've used that word microaggressions a few times now. Can you kind of take a step back and explain what that means and what you're talking about for people that don't know what that means?
A microaggression.
Or just an example would be great.
I'll give you a perfect example. I am the supervisor. a lot of times I will speak to people on the phone or speak to people in emails, and they'll come in and ask for the supervisor, and I'll say, "Oh, I'm Teresa. I'm the supervisor." "Oh, you're the supervisor?" That's a microaggression. Mm-hmm. So it's those little just subtle intentional or unintentional behaviors or things that are said that obviously have some sort of bias. And a lot of times I don't think people even realize that they're doing it. And to give you another example, there is an employee at the facility where I work who has been there for a number of years. Whenever they talk to me, they say, "Hey, girl," or something like that, or "It's girl this, girl that." I'm the only person who gets "girl." Everyone else gets "ma'am" or "ladies." So that they're just little subtle things like that. And with that, with the last example, I don't even say anything. It's not worth saying something about. It was definitely noticed the first time it happened and has been noted each time now, but nothing's going to change with that. There's no point in even saying anything and making it out to be an issue. But it's just those little comments that, and to give people an idea of it, just taking race out of it. It seems like doctors are getting younger and younger and younger. And I don't know if y'all, and I guess that's probably just because I'm getting older. I'm getting up there now. But when you're, as a technician, you're in the room with your doctor, or your doctor walks in and the client's like, you're the doctor? You're a baby. Really? You? It's along those same lines where it's like, why can I not be the doctor? Why can I not be the supervisor? Right. What is it about me when you look at me that doesn't say that I would be in that position?
Well, I think when it comes across like that, it's almost like a incredulous of like, oh, that's amazing. I can't believe that. But the way that it comes across to you is diminutive as, oh, there's no way that you could be a supervisor.
Teresa, I think that for me, the last question that I'll have about this topic of racism that we're talking about today would be whether in your current position as a supervisor, or even, you know, when you were, you know, working in the ICU or in technician jobs you've had in the past, do you feel like your opinion is viewed on the same level as your, you know, counterparts, be them white, Hispanic, what have you, that would be about the same experience or knowledge level? Do you feel like your opinion is viewed or valued on the same level, or no?
Absolutely not. I can say something, and I'm one of those people where if something comes out of my mouth, for the most part, when it comes to my job, I have something to back it up. I have a source, or I can say, go look up this or this. And it was my experience that I could say something and it was ignored or contradicted, or instead of listening to me and my experiences, we went with someone who was less experienced. And I always, I love to tell the story about how a doctor asked me for advice on something one time, and I told them no, that I didn't think what they wanted to do was a good idea. And I said it very tactfully as to not be disrespectful or insubordinate. And they did not listen to me. They listened to someone who was a technician who I had actually taught in tech school, who told them the wrong thing to do. And it ended up becoming a huge problem that could have been prevented if they had listened to the senior technician. But there was something about me and my background to where what I had to say just wasn't as valid as what this other person had to say. There are often issues. I don't think that I'm being taken seriously sometimes, but like I said, things have gotten a lot better. They can only get better. They most certainly, hopefully, can't get any worse. I will say that it has been my experience that people in this industry, particularly in vet schools, we are doing wonders and making such wonderful strides towards being more diverse and more accepting and inclusive. Almost every vet school in the United States, or at least that I know of, has a diversity officer, and they're working more towards inclusion. So we're cranking out all of these students who are going to be doctors that are not going to put up with crap. So in five or even 10 years, I think it's going to be a completely different ballgame, or at least I pray that it will be.
Yeah, I can tell you for sure Tufts does as well. And our, I don't know the leadership position of our diversity council, whether it's president or what have you, but she's one of our ophthalmology residents, and she's just out of this world amazing. And I know, you know, Tufts is very proactive about inclusion. And even though when I look at our student body year over year, and I'm in my fourth year there, so I'm kind of at the point now where I've really just had this class that just graduated was the first class that I had kind of seen start to finish. The student body year over year is still what I would say largely representative of most veterinary hospitals in the United States, where it's very, 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 very predominantly white. However, I do know that our school goes to great lengths to try to be inclusive on campus and through the application process. And as you said, hopefully, you know, that kind of trend can just continue to move forward, and we can kind of chip away at it a little bit more, you know, with each class as time goes by. And I guess one last question I would have too before we kind of transition away from this topic and wrap up is there anything else you want to get across to our listeners that are out there that maybe we haven't asked or we haven't brought up, points you want to make or stories you want to share or anything else to kind of put a period or an exclamation point on the start of this discussion? Because this won't be the only episode Dave and I do on this. Hopefully this will be another continuing conversation that we have. But is there anything else you want to talk about or get across to people that are listening out there?
I think the most important thing is just to be an ally, to say something when you see things going on, but also be cognizant of the things that you say to people in your hospital, to your coworkers, other technicians or doctors, and how what you're saying may affect them or make them feel. And I do have another story along those lines, just so you can know what I'm talking about. Several years ago, we had a patient come into the facility that I was working at that was laterally recumbent, temperature too high to measure, so over 109. And it's Louisiana, it was a dog that was obviously having a heat stroke. And we treated it as a stat. The clinicians went up to talk to the owners. And we did everything that we could for that dog, but unfortunately, it was my understanding that the owners had financial constraints and couldn't move forward, so they elected to euthanize the patient. And right before they were about to euthanize the patient, he popped up, and he would have made Cujo look like a lap dog. And afterwards, I was standing in a room full of people, and I said to one of my coworkers, I said, well, you saw the way that dog popped up at the end. I said, do you think that dog was actually just aggressive, or was that the rally before the end? And my coworker, who I wouldn't necessarily say that we were friends, but we were acquaintances, looked at me, and without batting an eye, she said, well, I asked Dr. Such and Such whether or not the owners were black or white, and she said that they weren't white. And given the fact that it was this breed that is a stereotypical breed that black people get, and that it's Louisiana and it was outside and it's not neutered, it was just aggressive because people who aren't white don't know how to take care of their animals. And I looked at her and I was shocked. I couldn't even say anything. There were other people in the room. None of them said anything. And I was just, I was so upset because not only was it said to me, but none of the people that heard it said anything. And I said something to my supervisor or to a supervisor, and nothing happened. And at the facility that I was at, when things of that nature are brought to a supervisor's attention, they are required to act. And when I saw that nothing was going to be done, I later learned that nothing was done because that technician and that supervisor were friends. I went to our supervisor, everybody's supervisor, and told them the issue. And that supervisor's response to me was, and I'm trying to quote her because things like that just stick in your head. She said that she couldn't believe that I was bringing something like this to her attention because it was ridiculous that I was making it an issue. Because the other technician didn't say that black people didn't know how to take care of their animals. She said that white people who weren't white didn't know how to take care of animals.
I don't see how that's any better.
I was like, so that's out of the frying pan and directly into the fire. And she was upset that she was going to have to contact human resources and that there was going to be an incident. And I was made to feel bad for addressing something that needed to be addressed, and went back to the room that we worked in. And within 30 minutes, everybody that I worked with knew that I had spoken to the supervisor and what was said. When inappropriate things are said, whether the intention to be racist is there or not, it needs to be addressed. If you hear it, you need to address it right then. If you're not comfortable addressing it, you need to speak to someone who can address it. But also, as for those who are technicians or DVMs in managerial positions, when an employee brings something like that to your attention, and something, especially something grossly inappropriate like that, or even something in general, and they tell you how it made them feel, it needs to not be belittled or swept under the rug. It needs to be addressed swiftly and promptly, and it needs to stay confidential as to not create animosity between everyone else, because for the rest of my time in that position, I was the girl who went to the head technician and who went to HR and who tried to get someone fired. All because I just didn't want to hear that black people don't know how to take care of their animals.
Here you are in a job where that's like your job.
Yeah, right.
Like, I mean, oh gosh.
Teresa, one last question I just thought of. These stories that you had of just these terrible things that have happened to you on the job, are you the only person of color that works in the practices that you've been at, or are there others?
Currently, to the best of my knowledge, as a technician at my facility, I am the only technician supervisor of color. I have never worked at another practice where there's been another black person, period, other than in academia.
So much to take in and so much to process. And
yeah, for sure.
Thank you so much for sharing your stories. These have been, as heartbreaking as they are, I think they're really important for our listeners to hear, to kind of understand what's going on and you know, get it right from the source of somebody that's experienced this. I feel like that's going to be really valuable for people to hear.
And especially too, because you said earlier at the outset, you know, in terms of being an ally and you know, when you have to take time and educate somebody about your experiences or your reality, you have to relive these situations. And every example you've given today, I know you've relived those experiences. And again, really want to thank you for your time, for talking about this with us and more or less educating, because we don't have those experiences. That's the only way we're going to know about them, so that we can be better about, you know, trying to move forward on this path. So, as I said, I know you had to relive some of that today, and I'm sorry that you had to, but I can't tell you how much I appreciate that you did.
Yeah.
Well, you're not quite done yet. Yeah, we have one more question. We're going to transition away from this discussion and lighten it up before we.
We usually try to end with a kind of a positive note or kind of a fun little note. So.
Yeah.
We have your Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question. Are you ready for it, Teresa?
I'm ready.
Okay. Would you rather? We know you have a young child at home. Would you rather fight 200 third graders or fight a bear with sharks for arms?
Oh, the other choice. The other choice. The bear with sharks for arms. Because my kid, when he's playing, I don't think he realizes how strong he is. And this kid has left some bruises. I would rather deal with a land shark chihuahua than fight a three-year-old.
I'd probably do the same thing, just because 200 third graders sounds absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and if I lose to the bear with sharks for arms, it's over quick. I feel like 200 third graders, like they're just going to trample me. And 200 third graders sounds like a stampede.
As they're trampling you, they're going to say mean things, because little kids are mean. My son the other day, my husband told my son, oh, isn't mommy pretty? And my three-year-old looks at me and he says, mommy's pretty, but she's kind of mean and fat. And I'm like, whoa, like, wait a minute. So yeah, as they're trampling you, they will talk smack as well. So I'll take the bear.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Teresa. We genuinely appreciate the discussion. And like I said, this is something that we hope to continue the discussion and just continue to open people's eyes, because again, you know, Dave, you talked about it earlier, same experience for me. We just, the numbers, the sheer numbers of people of color in this profession are so low that many of us don't get to ever the opportunity to work with right. people of color. And so we honestly don't know that this is the experiences that go on. And but also then, you know, realizing the role we play in that yeah. as well. And so, you know, we just need to be a bit mindful of that. And that's all, like, right, that's the whole point of the Vet Tech Cafe yeah. is have discussion, talk about things that we can do to be better. And this is just another area that we want to do that. Well, what do you think, Dave? Should we sign it off?
I think we should sign off. This has been a great discussion. I really love this episode.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you everybody for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. Hope you enjoyed your coffee. I hope everybody had a great time at IVEX. Those that joined the Zoom call, thank you so very much for doing so. And we look forward to talking to you again soon. Bye everybody.
Bye guys.